go.
Okay, it's a great pleasure today that we're with Simon Critchley. My name's Keith Ansel Pearson, and...
And I'm Daniele Lorenzini.
And I'm Simon Critchley.
And we're going to talk to Simon today in advance of his session of the post-Kantian European Philosophy Research Seminar devoted to his new book, Tragedy of the Greeks and Us. And we're going to ask Simon some questions about the book today. And it's a great pleasure, as I say, to have Simon with us. He's an old friend of the department. We haven't seen him for a good while.
Yeah.
And it's great that he's back with us. So the book that Simon's written is an inquiry into and a meditation on tragedy, especially the value of tragedy, and including the value of the experience of it. I guess one thing that especially interests me, Simon, about the book, and maybe you could talk about this to start with, is your reflections on why tragedy should matter to philosophy.
Because philosophy emerges as a counter-discourse to tragedy.
Can you elaborate on that?
That's a short answer.
Can you elaborate on that? You mean in its origins and its history?
Right. So the technique, the form of Socratic dialogue is developed very clearly in opposition to, in distinction from tragedy, but it also shares many of its features, notably that it's mimetic. So, and it features a protagonist, a heroic figure, not Ajax or Agamemnon, but Socrates himself. And the whole enterprise of Socratic dialogue is based around an anachronism between the time when Plato's dialogues were written, we're not absolutely sure when they were written, sometime in the 4th century, and the time of Socrates' life. And the context that Plato chooses to focus on for the dialogues are very specific, very punctual, very deliberate. So people somehow think of the Platonic dialogues as kind of transcripts of conversations. They're not, they're dramatic, they're dramas. And they're dramas which are set in a time when someone called Socrates is alive, and they're written by someone who was a student of Socrates called Plato. And the hinge around which the dialogues is articulated is the hinge of Socrates' death. So everything has to be seen through the anachronism of the time of Plato's writing and the time in which things are set. And tragedy uses exactly the same structure. There's anachronism between the time in which the tragedies are written, 5th century BC, and the time which is portrayed in the plays. The Bronze Age, the Trojan War, whatever it might be. But that technique of anachronism is also something that Plato developed. So Platonic dialogue and the violence of Platonic dialogue's exclusion of tragedy is to construct a counter-discourse to tragedy, and then also a counter-discourse which would also be a political counter-discourse. If tragedy is in a complex way, in a very complex way, a mirroring of the political form of the Athenian city-state, democracy, then Socratic dialogue is also in a mirroring relationship to another political form, which is critical of democracy, and the idea that we can establish some kind of government by experts or philosophers, of the kind of thing imagined in Republic and then reimagined in the last dialogue, the Laws. So
it's a counter-discourse.
It's a counter-discourse to tragedy, which then shares many of its features.
There's a couple of things you also say that I find provocative, or, well, pertinent in a way, and maybe you could just elaborate a little bit on these points. When you say that you seem to be suggesting that tragedy should matter to philosophy perennially or generally, because it counters what you see as either, well, on the one hand, the idealism of this philosophy, and the other would be philosophy's attachment to an excessive rationalism.
Yep.
Could you say a little bit more?
There's rationalism in tragedy. Tragedy is reasoned argument, back and forth. But usually reason does not have the last word. There are many, many words in these plays and stagings of argument, usually around two positions which are shown to be in conflict. Most famously, the conflict between, say, Antigone and Creon, around the meaning of one word, that word being law. Nomos, does law mean this, or does law mean that? And so it's reason all the way through, but reason can't burrow all the way down into the structure of ultimate structure of reality. It doesn't produce an ontology. And the other huge to cut to the chase a bit, I think that tragedy offers a form of thinking which is more amenable, more open to ambiguity, complexity, contradiction. It's based upon a fundamental skepticism about the nature of reality and a fundamental skepticism about what we do. So an ontological skepticism and a moral skepticism. And philosophy, at least in its Platonic form, but arguably this continues, the whole business of philosophy is about the conceit that the mind can peer through with the use of reason, can peer into the nature of that which is, and give us an ontology, a metaphysics, and on that basis derive certain moral views. And I think that, at least the more polemical side of the argument I'm making in the book, I think that at the very least needs to be rethought, or maybe it's a catastrophic error.
Can I ask you a very specific question on that, following up on that? Because for me personally, when I read the book, there's so many interesting things in it, but the most interesting thing was what you say, the claim you make about tragedy being a lifeline species of scepticism. Mm-hmm. So I just want to press you on that, because on the one hand, you could say there is an interesting tradition within the history of philosophy of scepticism.
Sure.
And so the people, and it seems pertinent to what you just said, that want to resist, if you like, the attraction of metaphysics in philosophy, to be more empirical, to be more particular, more local, to actually do justice to both intellectual complexity and moral complexity. And that's what the appeal of scepticism is for them. So people like Montaigne, I would say, Hume, and Nietzsche. So is there something, so this now leads to my question, is there something in tragedy that you think is either in conversation with that, and or is tragedy doing something else for you as a species of scepticism?
I think there's a scepticism in tragedy, scepticism about the ultimate nature of reality and the question, what shall I do? Moral question. And the plays perform an ambiguity and uncertainty. They are performances of a scepticism, if you like. Then that sceptical tradition, or that scepticism, you can find that, sure, in philosophy in many different forms, and we know it.
Even back to the ancient Greeks, to Pyrrho.
Yeah, well, the Greeks, you know, the Plato's Academy becomes sceptical in the 3rd century, and then, you know, when Carneades goes to Rome to kind of sell the brand of the Academy to the Romans, who were kind of the new power in town, he gives a speech in favour of justice and a speech against justice. So Platonism becomes sceptical. Then you've got the scepticism, which we know of intermittently later on through the texts of Sextus Empiricus and the Pyrrhonic tradition. And that sceptical tradition is a kind of shadow movement within the history of philosophy. And each of the three figures you mentioned, Montaigne, Hume and Nietzsche, they're sceptics, and I like all three of them for different reasons. But each of those three thinkers are thinkers that are fairly clear that the last word on what is the case and what is to be done is not to be given in a philosophical treatise. right? Mm. So Montaigne develops the form of the essay as a form of thinking, which allows for this ambiguity, richness. Hume, having written the treatise and it when he was very young, you know, what was important to Hume was the study of was literary criticism, history, and politics, right? This is what you should be doing. You should be spending your time doing philosophy. And Nietzsche, as you know better than I...
The aphorisms.
Aphorisms, and continually is developing new forms of thinking, or and describes himself as a tragic philosopher. So that skeptical tradition continues inside philosophy, but the need for metaphysics is great. And it's that, and so this might sound odd, but I see the why we're teaching philosophy is to try and cure people of the need for metaphysics.
That's exactly what Nietzsche says in Human All Too Human.
Exactly.
We have to renounce the interest in the first and last things.
Yeah.
And pay attention to the closest things.
And that's...
And we've got to liberate ourselves from what is taking this from Schopenhauer.
Yeah.
Is man's need for metaphysics.
Right.
So and that man is no longer the animum metaphysicum.
Right.
Nietzsche says.
Absolutely right. And that's something you can tell people and then they'll forget. Mm-hmm. And then they'll think, oh, this looks good. This seems to offer the truth about things. We'll do this for a bit. And every generation generates new metaphysical monsters, whether they are, you know, possible world semantics people, analytic metaphysicians, or whether they're Deleuzians and Badiouians, right? It's the same metaphysical need that's being satisfied. And so our task as philosophers is to kind of frustrate that and make that more complex. And history is a way of doing that. I mean, teaching is a way of doing that. This is fun.
Brilliant.